Well, last time I tried to describe to you the sense in which Einstein gravity may be thought of as the gauge theory of the Poincaré group. I must apologize for the somewhat uncouth mathematical presentation. I gather from comments afterwards it wasn't altogether transparent to the mathematicians. I don't think that's necessarily a fault of the formalism, but my own. By far the clearest and most elegant exposition of this can be found in papers of André Trautmann. So if people are interested in that, the theory is sometimes given the name Sharma-Kibble theory, Cartan-Sharma-Kibble theory, or whatever. I think the important point is that from the point of view of classical relativity, it's a sidetrack. It's not that exciting a theory, but it provides the conceptual framework in which many people in supergravity appear to view gravity, and if supergravity really is the correct theory, transcending Einstein's theory, we should really try to think in that way. I then discussed the super Poincaré group, and I gave an explicit representation, explicit action in fact, on superspace, just to show you that it does actually act. I wrote it like this. Put some indices on. So this set of matrices, where epsilon is an anti-commuting parameter, will multiply or compose, as you may check, and we need a theta here. So I've suppressed an index on theta, but if I want to put it on, it would be theta alpha. Alpha would be 1, 2, 3, 4. Alpha is real valued. And A would be, let's say, 0, 1, 2, 3. That's in four dimensions, and of course there are corresponding index ranges for higher dimensions. In the physics literature, these are called tangent space indices, and usually one uses Greek indices for so-called world indices, in other words, labelling coordinates. And I was a bit sloppy last time about transferring between them. Sigma is an element of spin, well, in general, n minus 1, comma 1. Lambda is its image under the standard 2 to 1 homomorphism in the Lorentz group. And just to clarify points, that sigma is really there. It looks funny, but if you compose these matrices, then the multiplication rule you can easily check. Is the following. Let's put a twiddle on the second guy. And you see it has a characteristic semi-direct product structure. To get that to work out, you've got to remember the fact that, in my notation at least, if I take two spinners, let's say chi and lambda, I guess, and that's the same as in other words, you can think of the Gann matrices as intertwiners between spin and Lorentz. So if you use that identity and multiply these matrices, you get this supergroup, so called, and it acts on superspace, which has coordinates xa and theta. Well, now we can divide, first of all, an element of the Lie algebra can be written as MAB Q bar gamma A over 2 PA 0.
That
gamma that you have between them. Oh, I'm sorry, I think gamma. That's better. Yeah, that's what I want to say. Okay. It's just a statement that, if you like, that lambda bar, gamma A, lambda is a vector under Lorentz transformations. So, it's conventional to label the Lie algebra generators with names. So, these generate super translations, and one typically writes A is a half omega AB MAB plus PA EA plus now a piece of the form Q bar psi, where the, I should say, indices are raised and lowered with this constant tangent space metric, where omega AB is called the spin connection, PA corresponds to translations, and psi is the rarefied Schwinger field, and it's a spinner vector. Spinner valued one form. So these are the gauge fields to start off. These are the gauge fields that we'll be constructing our Lagrangian from. And we can compute curvatures. So F, half RAB MAB plus PA TA plus Q bar rho, and the computation shows that RAB is the omega AB plus omega AC wedge omega CB. An interesting one is TA is DEA plus omega AB wedge EB plus a piece, I can write schematically as psi bar wedge gamma A psi all over 2, and rho is D psi plus a quarter omega AB gamma A gamma B psi. Now, in Einstein's theory, we can either work in first or second order formulism, and indeed for n equals 1 supergravity in 4 dimensions, that's also true. That means that we either impose a constraint on the torsion to begin with and then vary a constrained variational problem, or we try to solve for the torsion constraint from the equations of motion. In fact, N equals 1 supergravity in 4 dimensions was constructed in both ways, but for later applications it's actually more convenient to think of solving for the constraint and then substituting into the Lagrangian. The corresponding constraint for simple supergravity in 4 dimensions is just the constraint that the torsion vanishes. Now we can rewrite this in the following way. We can say the torsion of E, so this should be thought of as the torsion which depends on E, we can write this as the usual torsion. In other words, that would be the usual torsion, is equal to minus a quarter or a half, like psi bar gamma a psi, or we write this out in indices, the usual torsion is minus one quarter psi bar mu gamma A psi nu. So this is in fact what we should be using later. Just a check as a little exercise though, on the spinners, you could write this as psi alpha with its index upstairs mu gamma A alpha beta psi mu nu, where this is the pairing that was used in Fried's lecture. Now this is symmetric under these indices here, but these are anti-commuting, so in fact this is skew on the indices mu and nu, as expected. I beg your pardon, it's an alpha beta. So, in simple supergravity, our gauge fields are omega, psi, and Ea, but in second order formulation, we have that omega is schematically some function of E and psi, which I write down. Now the function that you get is just a result of applying the fundamental theorem of differential geometry, which is if you have a connection which preserves the metric and you're given the torsion, then you can deduce the connection from derivatives of the metric, or indeed from derivatives of the frames. And I'll write out the explicit formula that you get when you do that. So if you go through the standard procedure, solving, you will discover that solution of this constraint is omega AB is omega AB of E. So that's the formula you would have got if you were just doing the standard Einstein theory, but you add on another term. Now I'll put the index here. There are undoubtedly other notations which people might find more congenial. I've tried to use the one that is most common in the physics literature. when I write something like psi A, that's referred to the local orthonormal frame. It's a one form, but it's its components in the local orthonormal frame. Okay, so that's the explicit formula that we'll need later. Well, our task now is to find a Lagrangian. And before writing it down, it's interesting, we should think about how we might go about that task. I mean, it turns out you can write down a fairly obvious Lagrangian, which is obviously covariant with respect to usual diffeomorphisms, and then go through and check that it's invariant under supersymmetry. And I'll write that down shortly. So that's kind of inspired guesswork. There doesn't seem to be a right or wrong road of getting that full expression. But what you could have done is something else. And the technique that I'm about to describe, although cumbersome, is the underlying technique, I'm not going to describe it in any great detail, that's used in supergravity theories. The basic idea is to start with the linear theory, which is invariant under a certain set of abelian symmetries, and then try to modify it to make it interact, modifying the symmetry variation formulae as you go along, order by order in some series expansion. That procedure is called the Noether method. And it's algebraically rather cumbersome. Obviously, in principle, you're faced with summing an infinite series. But typically, people realize halfway through, oh, but the obvious covariantization of that expression is such and such. And so it's an exploratory tool, really, rather than a real proof. But that's how vast numbers of supergravity models have been constructed. You start with linear supersymmetry, and then you work your way up. That one could do with gravity. It would be absurd in the light of history to do it, although Feynman certainly tried, and that is to start off with a spin 2 theory on flat space and then build yourself up to a full gravitational theory. But in principle, it can be done. And if you believe that gravity is an effective theory, then there's nothing wrong with that procedure. There's nothing very profound about manifolds and so forth. So I don't think I want to go through that procedure for Einstein's theory, and I'm not going to go through it in detail for Geraertes-Schwinger theory or for supergravity, but I think that will motivate the next part of the lecture, which is just to ask ourselves, what is the theory of a spin 3 half field in flat space, which is probably unfamiliar to people. Okay, so schematically, the Lagrangian L is L Einstein plus L Geraertes-Schwinger. And I want to talk a bit about this, since I suspect it's unfamiliar to mathematicians in the audience. Firstly, one might ask, well, how do I know it's just Einstein plus Geraertes-Schwinger? There is a fundamental counting problem here, which was described by Dan Fried. We have enough degrees of freedom here to make a linear multiplet. We have the graviton, which has two helicity states, and as we shall see, the spin 3 halves has two helicity states, and they transform under themselves in linear theory. So at least that's the right degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's think of gravitini. Now, in fact, the abstract group representation theory doesn't actually tell us much about how to realize the fields in terms of a field representation. That's both its strength and its weakness. Its strength is, of course, you don't have to care, which is why Wigner embarks on that procedure. Its weakness is, if you want to make things interact, you want a specific representation. And the one that we want to use is using this spin of vector. So I claim that the flat space Lagrangian for a free massless Schrödinger field is the following. So that's just the totally anti-symmetric part of the Clifford algebra, totally anti-symmetric gamma matrices. In other words, it's And now we can look at the equations of motion. Well, now, if you take the variation of this guy, there's obviously going to be two terms, one of which is varying this guy, and one of them is varying this guy. But actually, by the symmetry, they're equal, so you can just vary that guy and multiply by 2. And so you read off immediately that the equations of motion this. And that's clearly invariant under psi lambda goes to psi lambda plus d lambda of some parameter epsilon. So that's looking indeed like a gauge theory, gauging a spinner transformation. So that looks like good news. In fact, we can use this to set gamma lambda psi lambda equals 0 by solving the Dirac equation. There exists an epsilon so that, really just taking the contraction with the gamma matrix. And the remaining freedom involves a solution of the massless Dirac equation, and we can use that to set d alpha psi alpha equals 0. Now, to make contact with Dan Fried's lecture, you can now pass to momentum space and sort of geometrical way of saying it is for each the momentum is going to be, so you consider solutions proportional to e to the I k dot x. Field equations tell you k squared is equal to 0, and so you have a sort of associated null hyperplane in the tangent space, and if you consider the factor space, let's call it that's n, such that k mu equals 0, then if you call this factor space n over r, it's can be thought of as Euclidean space in two lower dimensions. And what you need to specify the full polarization state, you can check from the calculations, is to give a spinner on E n minus 2 a spinner vector such that, well, if the spinner vector, if let's say gamma I the gamma matrices restricted to the factor space, you impose that constraint, and on the constant amplitude of this spinner. So if you do that in four dimensions, that gives you 2 degrees of freedom. And for later use, remark that in 11 dimensions, where this means that you've got E9, then you've got an SO9 spinner vector subject to this constraint, and if you work out the number of the degrees of freedom, you get 128 degrees of freedom, so in 11 dimensions. So that's the theory of a massless, non-interacting spin three-halves, so-called spin three-halves field. The terminology Rorschach-Schwinger is better, or Gravitino, because the three-halves is really appropriate notation or language only for four dimensions. So this guy we would like to couple to gravity. And the most obvious guess is to turn that into a covariant derivative and multiply by root minus g, and then we have some covariant action. However, there's a problem with that, which I want to explain briefly. And this problem is in fact solved by supergravity. You see, it's a bit delicate how you do this. And the calculation that I'm about to indicate is kind of a precursor to the more complicated calculations we shall do shortly. But I think it's quite an interesting one. So, minimally coupling to an arbitrary metric might lead one to try gamma mu nu lambda del nu del psi lambda equals zero. That's a perfectly good covariant field equation. Well, this is just the Levi-Civita connection. Two remarks are in order here. The Levi-Civita connection, when you write it out, has two pieces, at least superficially. When the derivative acts on the spinner, you've got to use the spin connection piece. And when it acts on the form, you might think you'd have to use a Christoffel. But actually, in this equation, you have the skew part, nu and lambda, here coming in. So actually, the Christoffel cancels. And so actually, you can call this D plus the spin piece. Now, if you were to postulate that this should be invariant, well, let's try it. Psi lambda is del lambda of some spinner epsilon. Well, now what you would find is that you have gamma mu nu lambda, and then you'd have del mu del nu on epsilon. That's supposed to equal zero. But this is a no-no because of the Ricci identity. In the conventions I'm using, of course this is a hostage to fortune if I've got the wrong one. Let's see, here's my magic sword. It's something like, you can use your favourite ones, this is the Ricci identity for spinners. So you see that when you hit this equation, you're going to get something of the nature of this R alpha beta mu, well now we've got to contract the indices, so there'll be alpha beta alpha, beta, mu, nu, epsilon, equaling zero. I'm sorry, I left out a couple of gamma matrices. Let's put those in. So, where do we want? Hang on. Let me just do it slowly. They don't match, so I'm going to fix it up. So what I want is something like lambda mu nu gamma alpha gamma beta. And epsilon zero. Well, now what you can do is use some properties of the cyclic identity for the Riemann tensor and some gamma matrix algebra, which I'm not going to go over on the board, but they're the kind of manipulations that will be familiar to people who've checked Lichnerowitz's identity for spinners. And in the end of the day, you find that you get a constraint that this is equal to zero, where G nu nu is the Einstein tensor. Actually, slightly unexpected. Why should you get the Einstein tensor? But that's what you get. So you get this constraint. We deduce, therefore, that the gauge freedom is lost on a background for which the Einstein equation, vacuum equation, does not hold. Only if the Einstein equation holds is this a consistent equation carrying the same number of degrees of freedom as in flat space. And this is what happens in supergravity. Supergravity imposes this condition. But for an arbitrary background, it wouldn't be the case. And this is a generic problem with higher spin equations. You impose differential subsidiary conditions on your equations, but they're incompatible with curvatures. So that tells you you can't have an arbitrary background. Okay. So the statement is, unless G mu nu equals zero, get inconsistency, where inconsistency means breakdown of gauge invariance. Supergravity solves this. Now those that have studied variations of metrics will understand you have the same problem in that theory. Variations of metrics, otherwise known as gravitons, arise when you write the metric as the sum of some background metric plus a small perturbation. And the linearized spin 2 equations coincide with the linearized gravitational Ricci flat condition if this background satisfies the Einstein equations. But if it doesn't, then the equation you're likely to write down is just plain inconsistent. And so that is the companion result to this. I didn't want to spend too much time talking about gravitons right now, but I'll just make that as a side remark. Okay. So now what about the action? Well, we could write the sum of the linearized actions, as I suggested, for a graviton and spin 3 halves, and work our way up using Noether's procedure. It's extremely painful, but actually we know half the answer, so the easiest way to proceed is to postulate the answer and check retrospectively. This is available to us in this simple case, but it is not available to us in more general cases, and then you have to go inductively checking the supersymmetry. Okay, so the action is R root minus G over 2
which is often written, plus 1/2 psi bar gamma mu nu lambda mu d nu psi lambda
root minus j. So that's Einstein. And this is the Rauscher Schwinger piece, and d nu is explicitly d nu lambda psi plus 1/4 omega hat a b gamma ray gamma b psi And I've rubbed it off, but omega hat is omega of E plus Fermi terms, fermionic terms. So omega of E means the regular formula for spin conduction. And this is the regular formula. Where actually I mean here R of omega and E hat. Now the claim is, and I'm not going to verify this.
This is in
no, this is in 4 now. Okay, so there was some race along the hall at CERN, apparently. Friedman and von Nievenhausen and Ferrara wrote down the thing almost, and then a more complete form almost at the same time, but in first order formulation is Deser and Zimino. So they didn't quite verify in that first paper all of the supersymmetry transformations. There were some 4,000 terms which they tried to check on the computer. You could get yourself into a maze of algebra if you do this. It's a real nightmare. Graham Segal says that mathematicians hate superspace. I'm not fond of it myself, but I think the only serious way of doing work in this subject is to use superspace. It's just a nightmare in components. Excuse me.
There's a comment at the end of Friedman and Al's paper that
that's right, to check the, I mean it's beyond belief if you write everything out, because there are a whole bunch of very large number of terms, they have to be checked with Fitts identities, and the Fitts identities are very specific to 4 dimensions. So I'll try and sketch the argument in a bit neater fashion. But that's how it works, and it is specific to higher dimensions. You can write this linearized action in any dimensions, and the first step will work. So the things I'm about to show will work, and then when you jack it up, it gets more complicated. You see, for example, you might try this in 5 dimensions, but in 5 dimensions the graviton's got 3 degrees of freedom, and this doesn't have enough degrees of freedom, so you have to add another degree of freedom, which comes from a photon, in fact. So the lowest model in 5 dimensions, which is supersymmetric, has got gravity plus a photon to get with a Chern-Simons term plus spin 3/2. You wouldn't see that if you thought, I mean, you only see that necessity when you really grind through the rules. Okay, so the supersymmetry variations are the variation of this guy. So that has got the spin connection in, and the spin connection of this formulation, remember, depends on psi itself. So it's already a non-linear transformation. I mean, in non-linear and fermions. And now the Fierbein transformation is epsilon bar gamma m psi mu. which then induces an obvious transformation on the metric. Now, one thing you can do, which is not too painful, is check that these curves is an algebra locally. So if I give you these formulae, then you have to change delta epsilon 1, delta epsilon 2 is delta, take the difference, and so they close up to diffeos and gauge transformations. So they're reasonable transformations from that point of view. Okay, let me sketch. I'm certainly not going to go through the argument. Let me sketch the argument.
This means you've got a nice super layout for combining diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's not quite, I mean, it's a soft algebra. Well, actually, I think in this case, you get structure functions in general.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's one of these. Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, I mean, there's a sensible geometric action and everything. And there's a lot of literature on this, but I never found it very easy to penetrate to the... It's a subject which I'm sure, I mean, just if I make a parenthetic remark, I'm sure that... geometers could clean up in a very nice way, because the physics literature, in my opinion, is a nightmare to read. Well, it's either diffeos or gauge transformations on this this chap.
But is that the gauge transformation that you're writing?
Oh, I'm sorry. No. You're right. I beg your pardon. No, the gauge. You're right. I beg your pardon. Yeah. It's just the diffeo, I think. Yeah. Now, the main point is that if you do the commutator of two of these guys, the diffeo is going to be generated by epsilon bar 1 gamma A epsilon bar epsilon 2. That's the vector field that you're going to get. And I'm going to come back to this point later. Okay, so this is going to be very schematic. This sort of calculation is one of those things that I personally think is best left to consulting adults in private. Maybe it can be cleaned up, I don't know. So let's check it at the simplest level. And the check is pretty straightforward at the simplest level. I'm going to be popping out over the signs because it was late last night. But a change in so first of all, you keep omega fixed, and I'll just do it about a background. Come back to that point later. But the standard variational formula for Einstein equations should deliver you something like this guy, where this is the Einstein tensor up to a total derivative. I think I'm worried by a factor of 2. And the variation of the spin 3/2 guy will give you, I hope the signs are right, this guy. So I take any variation of the frames. This is a variation in the metric, essentially, so that's the Einstein tensor, so that follows from that formula. Now, this thing follows because I've used the using the Ricci identity. And some gamma matrix algebra. Now the notation here is that GA mu is like the Einstein tensor, let's say, nu mu, and then contracted with one of these primes like that. It's just a referred to a different basis, if you like. Epsilon is the spinner that we're transforming. And you can see that these two terms are going to cancel if we use the formulae over here with appropriate signs and factors of 2. I think I've... oh, wait a minute. No, I don't think I want the factor of 2. I think that's there and that will work. Yeah. So, to quadratic order... in fermions and not varying omega, the terms cancel. Now you've got to go a bit further than this. You've got to incorporate the variation of omega, and you've also got to bear in mind something a bit more subtle. You've got to look at the four Fermi terms, but you've also got to bear in mind that the cyclic identity for the Riemann tensor is modified in the presence of torsion, so there are extra terms. So you don't actually just get the Einstein tensor when you come in here. Okay. Now, there is a trick or a little lemma which people use to avoid varying too much, which is to note that the constraint which is supposed to hold is equivalent to the statement that the action is vanishes with respect to omega. That's just an identity. In first order formulation that would be how you got the constraint, but this is just an identity for that formula for the torsion. And so when you do the variations of all the terms, you can forget the variation of S with respect to omegas. And this little trick is called the 1.5 formalism. So that trick cuts out many of those 4,000 terms, but there are still four Fermi terms to take into account, and I'm not going to pretend to do them on the board. There are various accounts in the literature, in the references I gave you, which give you enough hints to check it. Or better still, find somebody like Dan Friedman and ask him to go through it with you. Okay, so let's take a step back now and see what we've got. And focus on these equations, because in fact for the user, Stephen Hawking, whenever he hears something like K-theory, he says, well, can you give me a book called K-theory for engineers? And then he sort of thinks about it. Well, this is supergravity for engineers, if you like. Somebody has figured out what the formulae are for a symmetry of this system. And so it's now interesting to ask ourselves, can we have an invariant, a system which is invariant under supersymmetry transitions? Okay. And that corresponds to BPS states. Actually, there are no interesting BPS states in simple supergravity, but there are some plane wave states, which I'm going to occupy the last few moments of the talk with. Okay, so the point is that suppose we've got a bosonic background now, and we will assume, but we don't have to, with its own shell. So that means that psi is equal to zero, so it's otherwise known as just a metric. And now You see, the general background looks like this, and under a supersymmetry transformation, we're going to get something else. But it'll be invariant. The notion of isometry or superisometry would be that delta epsilon of E0 is equal to 0. That would be an invariant background. Otherwise known as a SUSY background or whatever. Now you see very cheaply from here that without worrying about four Fermi terms or anything, that's actually going to imply, it's going to imply that there exists epsilon such that d mu epsilon is equal to 0. Such an epsilon is called a killing spinner. Now the general definition of killing spinner is anything that this supersymmetry variation kills, and in general the formula for the super right hand side here will be quite complicated, but we always use the same word. Killing spinner is something for which the variation of the fermions, if there are spin half particles as well, that variation has to vanish. So this defines a killing spinner. So now we can investigate this equation in all dimensions, and we get an interesting answer. So this is, in this context, covariant constant spinner. And this is, of course, how the metrics of special holonomy get into the game of supergravity. Now, most people, when they think of metrics of special holonomy, they think about exotic things like G2 and all the rest of it, because they're thinking of Riemannian metrics. But the most important metrics for us are Lorentz metrics. So we can ask ourselves, can we have a Lorentz metric with a covariant constant spinner? Note that we make an immediate deduction, actually. At this level, this equation holds even if this is anti-commuting. So we're thinking, we can think now that this is an equation on a commuting spinner, since it's a linear equation. You can also check that if this is true trivially, then well, in this case, Ka is covariant constant, where Ka is now epsilon bar gamma A epsilon. In general, it will be a killing field, but that's if this is a more complicated derivative. But in this case, it's clearly a covariantly constant field. Now, another important lemma is that epsilon bar gamma ray epsilon is future directed light-like or time-like. This is this positivity property referred to in Fried's lecture. So what we know is we've got a covariant constant vector which is either time-like or light-like. In general, whenever we have a killing spinner, it's the square root of a causal killing field, and that's a very useful qualitative fact to know. Now, in the present context, it's pretty clear that if the killing field were time-like, it'd be a disaster, because the whole metric would split into a product of a time direction and a flat direction. So we don't want to go for that case. So we'll go for the light-like case. So suppose that Ka is light-like. Now, we can just try and solve this equation and see what we get. And I'll give you the answer. It's a well-known fact about general relativity, which has an interesting physical consequence. Okay, but it's a purely geometric problem now. Find all metrics with covariant constant light-like vector. And associated, and check, I guess, but it follows, that the associated light-like vector has a covariant constant spinner square root. So this distinguishes a whole class of metrics, and the metrics exist in all dimensions, so I'll write the formulae down in all dimensions. So this characterizes PP waves, as they're called, plane-fronted parallel gravitational waves. And now the metric to be written explicitly. So, the coordinates, we use this in a local chart if you like, are u, v, and x per. And morally, you want to think of u as t minus x and v as t plus x. In other words, these are, well, at least this one is a light-like direction. So, it's easy to check that dvdv is a light-like killing vector. That holds independently of what H is. I haven't said what equations H satisfies. Now, if you want the Ricci flat condition, we get the following Laplace operator acting on these. You see, we've got some flat variables here, these transverse variables. And I'll come back to what this characterizes means. Let me just say, for example, for the time being, this is the class of metrics for which this is true. In four dimensions, it characterizes it. In higher dimensions, we have some possibilities of adding some trivial metric with constant spinners here. So, but the main point is that you have this harmonic condition here. So, from an arbitrary dependence on this variable u. Now, this actually represents the gravitational wave, and I want to show why. It's actually, one remarkable property of this metric is, in fact, if you linearize it, you get the same metric back. And then it's identical to a graviton is, in fact, its own linearized approximation. Well, no, in fact, why is it a gravitational wave? Or what does it look like? And does it have the right number of degrees of freedom? Well, one way to view this is to think of a space-time picture, and the point is that the wave is moving, let's say, in this direction, so time is up here, and space is along here, and these surfaces are u equals constant. Now, you see that if I put u equals constant, and let's say x, if I put u equals constant here, it annihilates the first two terms. So the metric reduces to a degenerate metric. It's a hypersurface, but it's a null hypersurface. So that corresponds to a null hypersurface. It's the light front, or the wave front, of the gravitons. And the gravitons are moving to the right, and you can choose the profile function, h of u, arbitrarily. So you know with D'Alembert's equation you have some ripple and you let it go to the right. Of course there's a left mover as well, but when you superpose they interact. And so dvdv is pointing along here, and you can easily check that epsilon is the spinner which lives in the projection, I think it's of the gamma matrix. There are many harmonic functions, and using these harmonic functions and doing dimensional reduction, you can construct a lot of solutions which occur in the supergravity literature and in the string literature. But I don't want to do that at this stage. I want to make contact with the graviton counting that we had earlier. The graviton counting, in order to choose, choose H to be quadratic in X perp. If you choose H to be quadratic in X perp, you get some extra symmetries, transverse symmetries, and that really corresponds to an elementary gravitational wave. The fact that it's got a variation in the perpendicular direction might make you think that there wasn't a transverse symmetry, but in fact that's a coordinate artifact. There's a big group of transverse symmetries acting on this space. But the important point is that if it's quadratic, then H is given by a symmetric trace-free tensor on En minus 2. So there are as many degrees of freedom as there are a graviton, and indeed you can check, as I've said, that it's the linearized approximation to a graviton. Well now, this fits with the super representation theory because what we have in mind is that the quantum image of this thing is a light-like state and from the algebra which was shown to us by Dan Fried, we know if we have a light-like state then the algebra collapses. We get half the number of generators act as a Clifford algebra to give our representations, and then we get this Grassmann algebra which acts nilpotently on the Hilbert space. Now that corresponds to the fact that we have a projection operator on these spinners. Half of the spinners, which say are roughly constant here, say in linearized approximation, half of those spinners leave the background invariant. They correspond to the nilpotent algebra when we try to act on the Hilbert space. And the complementary half vary. They give us a metric and a gravitino. They move us in the multiplet. And so you see that we have... I don't want to write that down in big detail, but what we have here is an image in the geometry of what's happening in the representation theory. If we quantize this little system, then we would find that we had exactly those representations coming in. Now, that situation is rather generic, not necessarily for light-like states, but for BPS states. BPS states typically have some killing spinners, and when you want to act with the killing spinners on the background, you find that because those killing spinners are killing spinners, they leave the background invariant. Then there's a complementary set of spinners. Usually these are chosen to be constant at infinity, it's a more complicated story, and those give you the supergravity images of the other states in the multiplet. But I think that's all I want to say for today. Right.
General
thing.
Quite
different
end of the order. You say that unless the
Einstein
tensor is zero, you get consistency and
systems
solve it. So it sounded like you were saying that the
way supergravity
solves it is that you just
impose
the
Yonchow condition is the vanishing of the Ricci tensor.
But I thought the statement was that you had proportion in the connection. In the actual field equation is the source.
Well, it's true if you go to higher order in fermions, but let's look at it at the lowest order. The lowest order equations are Einstein equals zero, therefore no problem on shell.
If you're doing some sort of expansion...
Yeah, but I mean the whole consistency of the theory is guaranteed by the gauge invariance, which we checked, or in principle has been checked, right? And to get that gauge invariance to all orders, you have to check four fermion terms. That means you have to choose the right torsion. So you're absolutely right. It's a very tightly constrained system. You can't really monkey about with it. Okay. And it only works in four dimensions. In the higher dimensions, you need to add these extra fields to make the whole system tightly constrained. So the torsion is absolutely essential to get the overall consistency. If you did this in five dimensions, you'd ultimately find some inconsistencies, and then you'd have to discover five-dimensional supergravity, which has an extra vector field in it.
Thanks again.